Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 19 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, we're delighted to introduce guest interviewer George Miller. George has been working in publishing since 1989 and is highly regarded as a freelance translator and producer. You can listen to some of George's other podcasts on his website at www.podularity.com. Today, in the first of a two-part interview, the travel writer Jeremy Seal speaks with George about his 30-year fascination with Turkey and how he came to write his first book about the surprising history of a small red hat, A Fez of the Heart.
Hello and welcome to this Royal Literary Fund podcast. My name is George Miller, and I'm very pleased to say my guest in this programme is travel writer Jeremy Seal. I met Jeremy at his home in Bath on a hot day last summer, and we recorded this first part of our interview in his garden. Although Jeremy has written on a wide variety of places and subjects, including deadly snakes and the life of Santa Claus, his abiding passion has been Turkey, a country which has undergone huge change over the 30 years that he's been visiting it. The focus of Jeremy's first book, Affairs of the Heart, was a peculiar and peculiarly Turkish history of the small red hat that was banned because it symbolised everything that modern Turkey's first president, Kemal Atatürk, sought to sweep away: orthodoxy, conservatism, attachment to the Ottoman past. And the subject of his most recent book, Meander, is a 500-kilometre journey Jeremy made down that winding river by canoe to rediscover, as he puts it, the productive virtue of aimlessness. So the first thing I wanted to know when we met was how, back in 1984, Jeremy had come to find himself in one of Turkey's less attractive places, its modern capital, Ankara. Accident or design?
I did a teaching of English, a TEFL course, in London, in the summer of 1984, and in the way that the system works, I did well enough to be offered a series of jobs. I was offered Casablanca. It was rather like being a diplomat, actually. I was offered these various postings. I was offered Casablanca, and I was offered Ankara. And my presumption as a callow 22-year-old was that I should, of course, go to Casablanca. There was a film made about a place called Casablanca. It sounded romantic. And my father, who was obviously older than me and wiser than me, and was a naval officer, said that his experience of Casablanca was that it was a fairly dull place and that I should actually go to Ankara, if only because he knew nothing about it. So it was on account of that, entirely by chance, that I ended up plumping for this city, this steppe city in the middle of Turkey, about which I knew nothing, and was put on an airplane and turned up there one morning in September of 1984, and began effectively a new episode of my life. I had no idea what I was going to expect. I had no idea what I was doing there. But I did have a strong sense, which dated from some years before, of wanting to be away, of wanting to be elsewhere, and letting the experience of being elsewhere wash over me in whatever way it was going to. I didn't have any agenda. I didn't have any program. I just knew that whatever I was going to do with my life was going to have to present itself from elsewhere other than the UK, because certainly in my years prior to that, when I'd never left the UK, I'd had no sense there of what I might do or how I might settle or what I might become.
You say, I think, in one of your books, that when you arrive by bus in the bus station in Ankara, the taxi drivers automatically assume you want to go to the airport. They don't assume it's the kind of city that a visitor would want to spend time in. So what kind of city did you encounter when you arrived in 84?
It's effectively nothing more than a political statement. There is no reason for Ankara being where it is, other than the fact that it ain't Istanbul. When Atatürk, the great founding moderniser of Turkey, was looking for a new capital, effectively to disassociate the country with its old Ottoman, Constantinople, Istanbul-based past, he looked to the interior. And in the interior, he found, effectively, a steppe town, fairly godforsaken, very, very cold in the winter, dry and dusty in the summer, not, visually at least, a terribly attractive place. In the 1930s, it was laid out with Haussmann-style squares and boulevards and an empire-style station. So it's got this handful of aspirational architectural attempts at some sort of metropolitan grandeur. But beyond that, it got a great deal. So it wasn't as if I felt myself in a place of great historical or cultural glory or consequence. But I did find myself in a place which very quickly got under my skin. I was very struck by the sense not only of the overall situation of the country at a very, very formative moment. 1984 was 3 years after a military coup. Martial law was still in place in parts of the country. And actually, for a 22-year-old, that was very exciting. It suggested to me that this was a place very different from Chichester, Sussex, where I'd grown up. And also, because Ankara is in the, towards at least the geographical centre of the country, it allowed me every weekend to go off in a different direction, which meant that in the course of a year, I was able to take in what we know as Kurdistan, although the Turkish state would not allow that phrase, the Kurdish area, the Black Sea, the Mediterranean, the Aegean. I was able to go to the borders with Iran, to the borders with Bulgaria, and to get a very early foundational sense of just how rich and how interesting and how pivotal this country was, not only in geopolitical terms, but also in cultural terms too. I do remember a very strong sense that I could be eating Russian-flavoured foods on the border with Armenia, hummus on the border with Syria, and Greek-style foods on all along the Aegean. And I was really struck by the range and the extent and the possibilities of this country just by those early journeys. And effectively, because it was 1984, I was often doing these journeys on my own. I was going to places along the Mediterranean and Aegean coasts, which over the last 30 years have blossomed into mega resorts. But at the time, they were pristine beaches with a few tents on them. Heavenly, absolutely heavenly places. So the timing was good. Turkey was really beginning to emerge in all kinds of ways, touristically, politically, economically. And I suppose the last 30 years and my interest in the country over those 30 years has absolutely coincided with what has been a really key period for that country.
You mentioned in passing that before you went to Turkey, you hadn't done a lot of travelling. Yeah. So were you also at that stage discovering the joys and the challenges of being a traveller?
Yes, because of my father's interest, nay, obsession with sailing, all we had ever done as children, as regards holidays, was to go and get on the boat and go at the very furthest to northern France. So I know Cherbourg very well indeed. What this effectively meant was that any greater sense of travel beyond that had sort of been suppressed. And then in my 18th year, in my gap year, I went away to Australia and then to Egypt in quick succession where my father was a diplomat. That was the stage where I thought, oh, there is a wider world beyond Cherbourg, and it's a world that I really want to explore. And I think that was probably what underlay my decision a few years later, immediately post-university, A, to do a TEFL course, and to take that and to go abroad somewhere. So yes, by the time I landed in Turkey in 1984, beyond the week when I was teaching, I was absolutely waiting to explore that land and to travel absolutely as much as I could.
And solo travel is a particular kind of travel, isn't it? I mean, is it the case that the highs are higher and the lows can be lower?
I don't know. What do I think about solo travel? Actually, the more I think about it, there's a kind of self-reliance. The person who likes it, you can probably tell the sort of person who likes it. When I look at some of the other travel writers, they're very much of a type. Without naming too many names, I think there's a real remoteness. There's a self-reliance and there's a remoteness about a great deal of the travel writing types I know. A lot of them have married and have brought out families successfully, but I think that despite that, they appear to me to have a very remote streak in them, which sometimes is, to a greater or lesser extent, successfully suppressed, which allows them to lead a normal life in terms of families, wives, husbands, children. But I do think that there is a particular type who travels, and I certainly found that the real reason I enjoyed doing my solo travelling was because if you're travelling in company, you've already surrounded yourself with the world which you want to explore, i.e. it's the company of your friends. It's much easier to communicate with friends and with your immediate travelling company than what lies beyond that. And it's only when you're on your own that you expose yourself to whatever it is that lies out there, and that people in the country, in the territory through which you're travelling, are likely to respond to you, to communicate with you, and to begin to give you, after all, what it is that you're after in terms of material. It's very rare, it seems to me, that those travel experiences work well if you're as a couple. And I think about travel writing, and I think about some of those classic two-person shows. I think particularly of Redmond O'Hanlon. And that works in a particular way, but that's partly because he's travelling through territories where the cast, if you like, the wider cast, is fairly occasional and fairly remote. It's a jungle, or it's a river journey, and there has to be a reliance on the other person off whom to play, because the rest of the cast is out there and it's remote and it's beyond, in that case, him.
I suppose there may be maybe it's a facile comparison, but there may be a comparison with comedy, where you've got people who perform well as stand-up solos and other people who need the double act, they need the partnership to bounce off.
That's very, very true. I hadn't thought of it like that. But I certainly find, I mean, just to pursue that for a minute, it's actually easier. I think the way it works is that if I'm travelling on my own, a lot of the comedy that I hope ends up in my book tends to come out in the course, not at the immediate moment when it actually occurs, when the event occurs, but in the course of coming home, letting the experience ferment, develop, mature, and then rendering it on the page. So there's a sense that there is something amusing happening here as it happens, which may raise a wry smile to me, but it's actually a personal thing which only later in the course, as I say, in the course of turning, of rendering that into text, does the full comic effect come out. Whereas I suspect when Redmond O'Hanlon and, for example, James Fenton are travelling together, there's a strong developed sense there of the ridiculousness of their situation. So the humour there is presumably much closer to the surface and much more immediate and happening all the time than it would be in the case of an individual travelling and being more reliant upon him or herself for comic effect.
Yeah, you imagine that in the latter case, the routine is kind of almost being worked out, and it may be polished and refined later, but it's already taking shape between the two men.
I think that's absolutely right. And presumably, one of the reasons why, in that case, for example, they choose each other is because they know that they work fairly well as a comic double act, and that, for want of anything else, it may be that comedy is what's going to sustain them in what is obviously going to be a very, very hard journey. It has to be comic, because otherwise it would be dreadful. I think in my own travel, there are times when comedy feels very, very far away from the experience. It feels hard work. And often in normal situations, you do need somebody to actually make you see the amusing side of something which might otherwise be dreadful. And if you're on your own, you don't have that. You simply have to fall back on yourself and accept that at the time it feels very, very hard. But there was something underlying all that was fundamentally comic about this, that you're going to be able to dig out in the course of taking the notes home, thinking about it, and then in the light of a distant office at a distant desk, bring out the comic effect.
I read an old interview with you, Jeremy, in which you said you weren't an obsessive taker of notes when you were travelling. Is that something that's always been the case, or has that changed as you've developed as a writer?
I think that's always been the case. I have a memory that I feel I can rely upon. What I will write down are specifics, in the same way that I will photograph. I will use a camera as an aide memoir to capture a particular item or a particular sight, something of which I want to retain. But what that actually means to me, the actual specifics of what that means to me, I don't need to make a note of at that point. So most of my notes will be very, very shorthand. They will be phrases or words rather than fully formed sentences. The fully formed sentences come later, because it's only later that I work out exactly what I want to do with that particular original source material.
Will you be jotting down notes of conversations? Because your books, you know,
are full of conversations,
yes. And a lot of the flavour of the encounters you have comes from people's words.
Yes. There's always a problem with conversations because it's impossible practically to be sitting opposite a person, and even if one has shorthand, getting down every single word. So rather than do that, it seems to me, at least in my case, that the way I best operate is to just listen really, really hard. And then that is the one instance where I will take down as much as I can. So when the conversation is over and the moment that I'm in a quiet place, I'll get down as much of the phrasing, as much of the timbre of the conversation as I can possibly capture. But it will certainly be the case that the final rendered conversation will only be true to the spirit of what was said and to the tone of what was said rather than to the actuality of the words. I mean, I can't capture the actuality of the words because I've never, for example, thought of recording conversations that I'm going to have. I mean, I suppose it would be practically easy to do now without the subject even knowing that you were doing it with the like of smartphones. But I would feel uncomfortable about doing that. And I also think that it wouldn't be true to what I think I do well, which is to listen really, really hard and then take the essence of what I've heard, what I've absorbed, and then, as I say, render that on the page.
Because even if you were recording it digitally, you'd still be editing it, you'd still be selecting it, and crucially, you'd still be translating it too, wouldn't you? If someone's using dialect or slang, you'd still be thinking, well, how do I make this live and breathe in English?
I know. I mean, there are so many, particularly in foreign language, particularly in Turkish, to, as you say, the process of moving from the original conversation to turning that into the text in another language, edited and shaped and worked, is a very, very complicated, very, very complicated process. Having said that, it's one that, having done a fair few books, now feels fairly natural to me. I know exactly how I'm going to do it. And even as I'm listening to the person talking, I know the bits I want. I know the moments.
That was exactly what I was going to say. Do you sometimes think, you've given me a nugget of gold, that's definitely going in the book?
Absolutely. Yes, I do. To the point where it's the nuggets that stand out, it's the nuggets you want, and the rest is just about structuring a conversation which will allow those nuggets to sit comfortably and truly, if you like. So that process is really, really important, because it seems to me that travel writing per se, or at least the sort of travel writing I do, is about moving at reasonable speed through a country, through a territory, and therefore by nature, what you're effectively getting is conversations with people that you don't know very well. They're snatched conversations. They're glimpsed conversations. They're conversations with people who you don't necessarily trust. They don't necessarily trust you. And all you're really doing is just kind of capturing something in passing. And so the most important thing, apart from the actual content of the conversation, is getting the voice right, getting the tone of the person right. What is the person trying to tell you, and why is he or she doing so? Are they hectoring you about something in terms of how they regard you, or are they trying to persuade you? What are they doing and why are they doing it? And how do you best get that tone across in terms of communicating that conversation and the essentials of that conversation?
And the essentials of the person, what's the essence of the person as far as you can convey that? Just in a brief snapshot. And one thing you do is you often translate a Turkish person's surname.
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about how they come to have such colourful surnames, and also why you as a writer made that decision to translate their names for the reader.
Okay, so let's begin with the history. I'm struck by the fact that until the 1930s, Turkish people, as a rule, did not have surnames. They would be known as Ahmet, the son of Mehmet, for example. This was picturesque and this was colourful. But by the 1930s, Turkey, looking to modernise, and the architects of the modern Turkey had felt that one of the things they clearly needed were Western-style surnames. It was an imposition, in the same way that the new constitution was an imposition, and there were any number of impositions, including dress codes and the rest. The surname one was interesting was because Turks seemed to decide generally that if they were going to be forced to take surnames, they would take surnames which were sometimes bizarre, often surreal, often over the top and excessive. And possibly this was following the lead of their founder, Ataturk, whose surname means father of the Turks. So they all, in a fit of sort of grandeur, went for names which to us, with our somewhat abraded surnames, we have surnames which over the generations have kind of had the corners knocked off them. So when we hear the name Smithson, we don't really hear son of a Smith to the same degree. It's just a surname that we're very, very used to. When you hear Turkish surnames, you hear something very, very different. You hear, even today, the decision of the current generation's grandparents or great-grandparents to go with a name like Overthrower of Mountains or Lionhearted, or there are a whole range of them, and they're often bizarre and spectacular. And because of that, I wanted to render them where, if I had given the Turkish without explaining them, you wouldn't get the same feeling. And Turkish people have often said to me that they're quite struck by that, that when they read what I've done in English, they're reminded of how recently this very odd piece of social engineering took place.
So it renders it comprehensible, but also at the same time it renders it strange for the reader. I think that's a nice thing about it.
Yes, yes. Because I think it is strange. I mean, I think, you know, it's easy to forget that these people are the product of an extraordinary piece of social engineering over the last century. You know, until 1920 or thereabouts, they were the subjects of a 500-year-old theocracy. And a lot of the rules that governed the way that Turkish society worked until that time would appear to us, to the modern eye, to the modern ear, extraordinary. And then in the course of two decades, the new world was ushered in. In a way, in its extremity, is almost like what Pol Pot did in Kampuchea, Cambodia, or what Stalin did in Russia, or the Cultural Revolution in China, an absolute break with the past, a complete change to the future. So if you imagine between 1922 and the end of the 1930s, everything about Turkish culture was turned on its head. Religion was suppressed to a huge degree. The script by which people read their language was changed. The language itself was tinkered with to a huge degree. The dress which people wore was changed. The civil code was changed. The law was completely rewritten. In all sorts of fundamental ways, this was an extraordinary attempt to remake an entire population.
So it's not at all surprising that there remain deep clefts, deep fissures, deep divisions between the old and the new in Turkey. I mean, in some ways, it's surprising that those are not even more pronounced. It's surprising the extent to which this program has actually become enracinated, it seemed to me.
I think you're absolutely right. What's happening now in Turkey reminds us of the fact that what Ataturk did from 1922 and what his successors, what his followers did for much of the rest of the 20th century was effectively an imposition. It was an imposition, it was unwanted imposition upon the mass of the people. The reason he managed to institute it, to implement it, was because he was such a hero given what he'd managed to do in 1915 at Gallipoli in the independence war between 1919 to 1922, gave him enormous political leverage to do what he liked. If he hadn't been that hero, he would not have got away with this. This would not have stuck politically. But, I mean, I've read and I've spoken to any number of Turkish people who've said precisely that. We admire Ataturk wholeheartedly for what he did for us militarily, but a lot of us despise him for his imposition of what we regard as infidel values. That is what is coming home to roost now in Turkey, absolutely. What Turkey discovered from 1950, when there were the first proper democratic elections and when the Islamist opposition was swept to power, was that the majority of Turks did not approve of, did not want the revolution which Ataturk imposed upon the country. They wanted something much more traditional. So you've got the majority, as I say, reactionary, looking back, wanting the old certainties. And you've got the minority who entirely bought the Ataturk vision and went with it. And those two sectors of society are now fundamentally opposed to each other in a very worrying way. And it seems to me that we've arrived at a time now when, for the first time, the old Islamist opposition has got itself into a position of sufficient power that it can begin to overtly question that whole heritage, that whole Ataturk heritage, and to say, despite the fact that Ataturk is deified and enshrined in the history of this country, we may be able to begin to dismantle it and to take the country in a different direction. That suggests that a real fault line, which has always been there, is now visibly opening for the first time, which makes the country an absolutely fascinating place to explore at the moment and to write about. But it's a very worrying time. It really is. I mean, there is more social unrest and lack of harmony in Turkey now than there has been for a long time.
Well, I'd obviously want to come back and explore that in more detail, but take us back to 1984, 1985, Jeremy. You'd had your year teaching in Ankara. At the end of that, did you think, well, it's time to go back to Blighty and get a proper job?
And I thought, do I want to do another year in Turkey? No, I went home. I went home and I went into publishing. And I regret that decision now. I think I should have stayed another year or two, which would have allowed me to consolidate my Turkish, if only because I've now spent a disproportionate amount of time over the decades since then trying to catch up with the Turkish, trying to get the Turkish to a level I suspect I'd have got to much more quickly had I stayed. So I went back. I went into publishing and began to realize from a very early stage that I didn't really want to publish. I really wanted to write. And that the place I wanted to write about was the place I had just left. So it was almost at that moment that the two elements first suggested to themselves with any great force. The two professional elements for me, vocational elements, suggested themselves. One was the writing, two was Turkey.
Did you set about it as consciously as thinking, well, you know, what is my first book going to be? What are my themes going to be? Or how did that emerge more gradually?
I left Turkey in 1985 and I went back for the first time 3 years later in 1988. By which stage I'd begun to try to place travel articles. I'd begun to experiment with journalism. How might I do it? Is there a market for it? Am I good enough? And I went back to Turkey, and at that point I found myself thinking, I'm fascinated by this place, and I want to write about it, and how do I begin to do that? So I began to do that by writing travel articles. It was not until 1992, by which stage I'd written a few travel articles, that I thought, is there a book in me? What might that book be? And it came about in a very particular way. I remember sitting down, New Year's Day, 1993, with some good mates, and they were looking at me feeling that I needed to push on with my life because they were all being rather successful already, much to my chagrin. So they said, well, you need to write a book, and you need to write a book about Turkey because you appear to like Turkey. What will your subject be? And somebody on that hungover morning in Wales in 1990, on New Year's Day in 1993, seemed to suggest the Fez. I don't know who it was. Somebody suggested, you know, why don't you know, that's what I associate with Turkey. What do you know about it? And I said, well, that's fascinating. I know it was banned. And they said, well, it can't have been banned. It's a hat that comedians wear. You know, what is that collision aura about? How can you have those two different notions of a hat? And isn't there something in that? And I knew at that moment there's a subject there. That's how it began. And in fact, even on that occasion, somebody came up with this ridiculous title, A Fez of the Heart. So we had a title, I had a subject, and at that point I sort of embarked on what was the first book.
Jeremy Seal. That's the end of this first part of our interview, but I hope you'll want to listen to part two, in which we talk about how Jeremy overcame his fear of deadly snakes the hard way, how he prepared for a 500-kilometre river trip in Turkey by paddling around in the Avon, and what challenges he sees in Turkey's future. You'll find details of Jeremy's books at the Royal Literary Fund website, rlf.org.uk. That's all for this podcast, so until next time, thank you very much for listening.
That was Jeremy Seal in conversation with George Miller. You can find out more about Jeremy on his website at www.jeremyseal.com. And that concludes episode 19, which was recorded and produced by George Miller. Coming up in episode 20, the poet and librettist Robin Bolam speaks with Julia Kopus about Eliza's Babes, her anthology showcasing four centuries of women's poetry. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. to subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.